that is dead. Obtaining such approval at the top had rarely been difficult. Ephraim tossed a bag of pastries onto one of the folding tables, where Rafi and Shaul were plowing through research. Amos was in a corner at the computer studying maps of Bologna, Italy. Most of their research was stale. It included pages of mainly useless background on Joel Backman, information that had been collected years ago. They knew everything about his chaotic personal life, the three ex-wives, the three children, the former partners, the girlfriends, the clients, the old lost friends from the power circles in D.C. When his killing had been approved 6 years earlier, another Kidan had worked urgently putting together the background on Backman. A preliminary plan to kill him in a car accident in D.C. had been jettisoned when he suddenly pled guilty and fled to prison. Not even a Kidan could reach him in protective custody at Rudley. The background was important now only because of his son. Since his surprise pardon and disappearance 7 weeks earlier, the Mossad had kept two agents close to Neil Backman. They rotated every 3 or 4 days so no one in Culpeper, Virginia would get suspicious. Small towns with their nosy neighbors and bored cops presented enormous challenges. One agent, a pretty lady with a German accent, had actually chatted with Neil on Main Street. She claimed to be a tourist and needed directions to Montpelier, the nearby home of President James Madison. She flirted, or tried her best to, and was perfectly willing to go further. He didn't take the bait. They'd bugged his home and office, and they listened to cell phone conversations. From a lab in Tel Aviv, they read every one of his office emails and those from home as well. They monitored his bank account and his credit card spending. They knew he had made a quick trip to Alexandria 6 days earlier, but they did not know why. They were watching Backman's mother, too, in Oakland. But the poor lady was fading fast. For years they had debated the idea of slipping her one of the poison pills from their amazing arsenal. They would then ambush her son at her funeral. However, the Kidan Manual on Assassination prohibited the killing of family members, unless said members were also involved in threats to Israeli security. But the idea was still debated, with Amos being its most vocal proponent. They wanted Backman dead, but they also wanted him to live a few hours before passing on. They needed to chat with him, to ask some questions, and if the answers weren't forthcoming, they knew how to make him talk. Everyone talked when the Mossad really wanted answers. "We have found 6 agents who speak Italian," Ephraim said. 2 will be here this afternoon, at 3 for a meeting." None of the 4 spoke Italian, but all spoke perfect English as well as Arabic. Among them, there were 8 other languages. Each of the 4 had combat experience, extensive computer training, and skill at crossing borders, with and without paperwork, interrogation, disguises, and forgery. And they had the ability to kill in cold blood with no regrets. The average age was 34, and each had been involved with at least 5 successful Kidan assassinations. When fully operational, their Kidan would have 12 members. 4 would carry out the actual killing, and the other 8 would provide cover, surveillance, and tactical support, and would clean up after the hit.
"Do we have an address?" Amos asked from the computer.
"No, not yet," said Ephraim. "And I'm not sure we'll get one. This is coming through counterintelligence."
"There are 500,000 people in Bologna," Amos said almost to himself.
400,000, said Shaul, "and 100,000 of those are students." "We're supposed to get a picture of him," Ephraim said, and the other 3 stopped what they were doing and looked up. "There's a photo of Backman somewhere, one taken recently after prison. Getting a copy is a possibility."
"That would certainly be helpful," Rafi said. They had 100 old photos of Joel Backman. They had studied every square centimeter of his face, every wrinkle, every vein in his eyes, every strand of hair on his head. They had counted his teeth, and they had copies of his dental records. Their specialists across town, at the headquarters of Israel's Central Institute for Intelligence and Special Duties, better known as Mossad, had prepared excellent computer images of what Bachman would look like now, 6 years after the world last saw him. There was a series of digital projections of Bachman's face at a hefty 240 pounds, his weight when he pled guilty, and another series of Bachman at 180, his rumored weight now. They had worked with his hair, leaving it natural and predicting its color for a 52-year-old man. They colored it black and red and brown. They cut it and left it longer. They put a dozen different pairs of glasses on his face, then added a beard, first a dark one, then a gray one. It all came back to the eyes. Study the eyes. Though Ephraim was the leader of the unit, Amos had seniority. He had been assigned to Bachman in 1998 when the Mossad first heard rumors of the JAM software that was being shopped around by a powerful Washington lobbyist. Working through their ambassador in Washington, the Israelis pursued the purchase of JAM, thought they had a deal, but were stiff-armed when Bachman and J.C. Hubbard took their goods elsewhere. The selling price was never made known. The deal was never consummated. Some money changed hands, but Bachman, for some reason, did not deliver the product. Where was it now? Had it ever existed in the first place? Only Bachman knew. The 6-year hiatus in the hunt for Joel Bachman had given Amos ample time to fill in some gaps. He believed, as did his superiors, that the so-called Neptune satellite system was a Red Chinese creation, that the Chinese had spent a hefty chunk of their national treasury in building it, that they had stolen valuable technology from the Americans to do so, that they had brilliantly disguised the launching of the system and fooled U.S., Russian, and Israeli satellites, and that they had been unable to reprogram the system to override the software JAM had uploaded. Neptune was useless without JAM, and the Chinese would give up their Great Wall to get their hands on it and Bachman. Amos and Mossad also believed that Farouk Khan, the last surviving member of the trio and the principal author of the software, had been tracked down by the Chinese and murdered 8 months ago. Mossad was on his trail when he disappeared. They also believed the Americans were still not sure who built Neptune, and this intelligence failure was an ongoing, almost permanent embarrassment. American satellites had dominated the skies for 40 years and were so effective they could see through clouds, spot a machine gun under a tent, intercept a wire transfer from a drug dealer, eavesdrop on a conversation in a building, and find oil under the desert with infrared imagery. They were vastly superior to anything the Russians had put up. For another system of equal or better technology to be designed, built, launched, and made operational without the knowledge of the CIA and the Pentagon had been unthinkable. Israeli satellites were very good, but not as good as the Americans. Now it appeared to the intelligence world that Neptune was more advanced than anything the United States had ever launched. These were only assumptions. Little had been confirmed. The only copy of JAM had been hidden. Its creators were dead. Amos had lived the case for almost 7 years, and he was thrilled to have a new Kidon in place and was urgently making plans. Time was very short. The Chinese would blow up half of Italy if they thought Bachman would end up in the rubble. The Americans might try and get him, too. On their soil, he was protected by their constitution with its layers of safeguards. The laws required that he be treated fairly, then tucked away in prison and protected around the clock. But on the other side of the world, he was fair game. Kidon had been used to neutralize a few wayward Israelis, but never at home. The Americans would do the same. Neil Bachman kept his new, very thin laptop in the same old battered briefcase he hauled home every night. Lisa had not noticed it because he never took it out. He kept it close, always within a step or two. He changed his morning routine slightly. He had bought a card from Jerry's Java, a fledgling coffee and donut chain that was trying to lure customers with fancy coffee and free newspapers, magazines.